This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Doe Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
Hello, we've got a few questions this week. The underlying theme for the answers is that there's a simple answer, but there's a whole other complicated answer that goes along with it. The first question comes from Solar Crescent on the forum, who asks, what is the boiling temperature of water in space? Now, most people know that as you go up through the Earth's atmosphere, the temperature at which water boils drops. It's why you can never make a good cup of tea up a mountain, why the Swiss invented pressurized coffee machines. The boiling point of water depends on the atmospheric pressure. At about 60,000 feet up, the boiling point of water is low enough that it's below your body temperature. If you stepped outside a balloon at 60,000 feet, the fluid in your body would boil. The only person ever known to have experienced this and lived said that before he passed out, he felt the spit boil in his tongue. If you keep going up, there reaches a point where the boiling point of water becomes so low it's the same as the freezing point of water. We call this triple point, and it's about 90,000 feet above the Earth's surface. Above this height, unpressurized water can't be liquid, so it can never boil. What it can do, though, is sublime like carbon dioxide or dry ice does. It turns directly from ice into a gas. But if you keep going up, you eventually reach outer space, which is what we want to talk about in the first place. Now, there's no real edge to outer space, but it's usually taken to be about 100 kilometers up. The pressure here is about a millionth of what it is at sea level, and water sublimes to about 170K, or minus 100 degrees C. And if you take a ball of ice up to the middle of space and heat it up, it will be about this temperature, 170 Kelvin, or minus 100 degrees centigrade, that steam starts coming off it. That's why comets appear not to have tails when they're a long way from the sun, because they're too far away from the sun for water to sublime the ice in them. So that's the simple answer. The complicated answer is that it depends what you heat it up with, and how long you give it. If you stick an ice cube in space, the UV radiation from stars can knock off individual atoms or molecules, and the ice cube will eventually vaporize. But this might take a few million years. So you'll find astronomers, instead of talking about boiling points or even sublimation points, talk about radiation temperatures, equilibrium temperatures, hard radiation, soft radiation, all because things get a lot more complicated when you're working in a vacuum on timescales that make ice ages look like a passing fashion. For most purposes you're likely to think of, though, water will sublime at about minus 100 degrees Celsius in space. Our second question comes from Vasily Galkin in Russia, who asks via email, what is the dividing line, if there is any, between star clusters and galaxies? How do you distinguish, say, a very large star cluster from a very small galaxy? Well, privyet, Vasily! I picked your question because most of the work I do actually looks at big star clusters and small galaxies, if not the dividing line between the two. And your question also illustrates how our understanding of the universe is continually evolving. The simple answer is, there isn't a division between star clusters and galaxies to speak of. But to understand why we call some groups of stars galaxies and some clusters, we need to go back through the mists of time to when these objects were first discovered. Early astronomers, like Charles Messier and William Herschel, when they were putting together the list of things in the night sky that didn't look like dots, grouped similar-looking objects together. When they saw groups of stars, they called them clusters. When they just saw a fuzzy blob, they called it a nebula. And so everything ended up being either a cluster or a nebula. Now, many years later, we found out that some of these nebulae were also made up of stars. It's just that they were very far away, and there were so many stars that the early astronomers couldn't make them out in their small telescopes. It wasn't until Edwin Hubble came along and actually worked out how far away these things are that we realized what a galaxy actually was, and that our Milky Way was only one galaxy among many. So then we had stars, which came in clusters, and galaxies. In the last 100 years or so, we've had a better chance to look around these clusters and galaxies. Clusters are relatively small, from a few stars to a few million stars, and that is still small. They're usually fairly compact, usually fairly spherical, and they're usually part of a bigger galaxy. Typically, the stars form from the same clouds, they all have the same age and composition. Galaxies, on the other hand, tend to be big, massive, sprawling, isolated metropolises, with billions or even trillions of stars. They usually have some shape, be it a spiral, or an ellipsoid, or even just some amorphous irregular blob. Many still have lots of dust in them, and these continually form stars, so galaxies normally have stars of very different ages and very different compositions. But the closer we look, the more objects we find that have some features of both clusters and galaxies. There are small galaxies that orbit inside bigger galaxies, like Magellanic Clouds. There are big clusters that have stars of different ages and compositions, like Omega Centauri. So in the last few years, the dividing line between clusters and galaxies has started to blur. The whole business is a bit like asking what separates a planet from a lump of rock. In the past, it was easy. We had big planets, we had small lumps of rock. But then we found a lot of objects that looked a bit like planets, but still quite like lumps of rock. And we had to ask, what makes a planet? So we ended up coming up with a set of criteria that led us to demote Pluto from planethood. And a bit like planets and rocks, there's no physical dividing line between clusters and galaxies. We have to ask, what makes a galaxy? And if anyone has been watching the BBC QI programme recently, they'll know that the answer is, nobody knows. Like we did with planets, we still have to come up with a precise definition of what exactly is a cluster, and what exactly is a galaxy. Until then, we'll never be able to separate the two. Our third question today comes from Richard Elvin, who asks via email, will New Horizons ever overtake the Voyager probes in terms of distance from the Sun? And if so, when? Okay, well, to answer this question, let's start by seeing where each spacecraft is now. Voyager 1 is currently 119 AU away from the Sun, that's 119 times further away than Earth, and is moving away at about 10.5 miles a second. Voyager 2 is currently 97 AU away from the Sun, and moving at 9.3 miles a second. New Horizons, meanwhile, is en route to Pluto and has just passed the orbit of Uranus, so it's 22 AU out, and keeping pace with Voyager 2 at 9.3 miles a second. So Voyager 1 is way ahead and it's increasing its lead, so this really is a one-horse race. Voyager 1 will always be the furthest of the three. Simple answer, done. But what about the other two? Voyager 2 and New Horizons are moving away at similar speeds, but taking very different courses. Voyager 2 is flying merrily through space to fairly constant rate, having left the worst of the Sun's gravity behind. New Horizons, meanwhile, is slowing down due to the Sun's gravity, but still has an encounter with Pluto to come. Quite what happens when New Horizons passes Pluto hasn't been decided yet. It may speed up or slow down as it visits other Kuiper Belt objects, but it's unlikely to ever reattain the speed that Voyager 2 has now, so it's unlikely to overtake it. I'm afraid New Horizons will always be that little bit left behind. Our final question comes from Jeff, who asks via email, why is light bent as it passes close to the Sun? A pint is resting on your answer. Well, the simple answer is that the light is bent because the mass of the Sun curves the space around it. The complicated answer is that Einstein's theory of general relativity prescribes that the curvature of space-time by a massive body, alongside associated effects including the Shapiro delay, frame diagonal and Stirring precession, and gravitational redshifting, pushes the photon's path from a straight vector in Euclidean space to a curved vector, but this is merely a three-dimensional projection of the shortest path in four-dimensional space-time. The very simple answer is that your friend owes you a pint.